This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today, actually we had two speakers, Dr. Helene Gale, who's the president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, and she was interviewed by Judy Sue, anchorwoman at ABC7 in Chicago. Dr. Gale is the new president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, a 102-year-old organization that's only had seven leaders in more than one century, and Dr. Gale is the first woman to head the Chicago Community Trust. Dr. Gale is a physician, pediatrician who was born in Buffalo, New York. She was drawn to the Chicago Community Trust after a lengthy career at the Center for Disease Control. She headed up the CARE organization, which operates in 87 different countries, and she saw taking over and running the Chicago Community Trust as new challenge and new opportunities. Dr. Gale said she's very concerned with inequities, race, gender, class, caste, housing, education, employment, opportunities, and more. She said Chicago has a real entrenched challenge available to her, but it has a tremendous sense of goodwill and an initiative to solve many of the problems that we face. She says we have to get our own house in order and address the inequities before we can move back to center of the world stage. The Trust's agenda, last year they gave out 1,500 grants, ranging from millions of dollars down to several thousand dollars, is formed by the clients and partners. The Trust, she said, exists to serve the Chicago region. Historically, they've been concerned with such areas as public safety, jobs, education, racial tension, and segregation. We're going to do some refocusing so that we can become more action-oriented. The Trust works with many generations of philanthropic groups and families. A good example is an over 50-year relationship with the Cyril Foundation. She talked about two groups that they're working with now, a group called Sweet Beginnings, which takes former people who are involved in the criminal justice system, and they're developing honey and food products and body products that are now available in several of the supermarkets in the Chicago area. And she talked about another company called Garfield Produce that also works to find jobs for those who are hard to employ. And currently they're on tack to produce 100 pounds of microgreens a week, which will result in $250,000 in revenue weekly. The Trust is trying to attract younger philanthropic people. In other words, techies who've made a lot of money, who are interested in social impact and sustainable business models. Dr. Gale finished up her presentation by saying the challenges are always refreshing and new, and she hopes to solve some of our city's problems.
Thank both of you.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you. Thank you very much. There was only one thing Ed left out of my introduction, which is, if for those of you who are longtime ABC7 watchers, I was also the news anchor who had the baby on the expressway. That was, so I don't just cover breaking news. I didn't even tell
you
Dr. Gale that. Yes. You know, I made breaking news that morning. It was 4 o'clock in the morning on the way to... Anyway, never made it. So that's me. It's lovely to be with all of you today, and great to be on stage with Dr. Gale. Dr. Gale and I actually had a long-format sit-down interview soon after she came to Chicago to head the Chicago Community Trust, so it's great to learn about her passion, and I'm so excited to share what you had to offer to everybody here today. But I think the biggest question that may be on everybody's mind is, given our beautiful day here, how was your first winter here in Chicago?
Well, actually, this has been a pretty mild winter. You know, and when I first said I was moving to Chicago, all of my friends were laughing. You know, I'd lived in Washington, D.C. for a long time. I lived in Atlanta for many, many years. And everybody was laughing about me moving to Chicago. I've always said, I'm from Buffalo, New York, originally. And I always said, I am never, ever going back to cold climate again. And my husband, who's here, who's from Chicago, said he was never going back to cold climate or Chicago again himself. So you never say never. Anyway, best advice I got, buy a warm coat. I did. Live close to your office. I do. And as a result of that, this has been a pretty mild winter. And the other thing is, when I talk to my friends from all around the country, this weather isn't particularly good anywhere. This has not been a good winter. I keep getting stuck every time I go to New York City because of snowstorms. We might want to get into climate change, whole other issue. But clearly, weather patterns are not what they used to be.
So weather aside, clearly not the biggest draw for people to move to Chicago. What drew you, though, to the Chicago Community Trust? Because as we heard in your background, it's mainly globally focused. For a long time, you travel the world, and now you're here in Chicago. What drew you to one of the largest and oldest foundations, the second oldest in the country?
Well, I could blame that woman right there, Sheila O'Grady, who headed the search that brought me, and thank you, Sheila. But I guess everybody's life has some sort of arc. And in retrospect, sometimes it seems like it's well planned and makes a lot of sense. But usually it's some mix of opportunity, timeliness, readiness, and some of those sort of things. So, you know, I started my career out as a physician. And I did that because I wanted to have a very practical skill that could make a difference in people's lives. And so I also knew, though, that, and some of this came from my time as a pediatrician, that I continued to see things that made me realize that just focusing on individuals was not really going to make the kind of change that I wanted to make. Because you saw, I'm a pediatrician, I would see children come in and out of the hospital, in and out of emergency room, in and out of clinics. And a lot of times, the factors that led to that were more societal and social factors. And so I really started thinking about how could I take medicine, the practice of medicine, and take it from an individual level to a population level. That led me to thinking more about public health. I got a degree in public health, went to the Centers for Disease Control for a couple of years in a training program, thinking I'd stay 2 years, stayed 20. Mm-hmm. As I realized how important some of the work that CDC was doing. But I got very involved, as was mentioned in the introduction, in the HIV epidemic. Yeah. And, you know, for anybody who's been involved with HIV, you know, yes, it is an infectious disease. Anybody can get it. But at the end of the day, it is not randomly distributed. And in some ways, HIV, like so many other illnesses that we have, really show our societal fault lines, because people who were disproportionately impacted by HIV were often poor, discriminated against because of sexual orientation, people of color, et cetera. So people who were poor or marginalized, stigmatized, were more likely. And so, you know, looking at some of these societal issues in this country that were all about inequity, I started getting very involved also in the global HIV epidemic. Okay. And some of those same sort of societal factors are what undergirds risk for HIV globally, just like it does here. And as I kept searching for how do you not look just at Band-Aids and fix short, quick fixes, but how do you actually look at the underlying root causes, I got much more engaged in looking not just at health, because in the health box, in the health toolkit, you can only do but so much. But if you really want to have an impact on health and health inequity, whether it's HIV or anything else, you've got to look at housing. You have to look at transportation, education, economic opportunities. And so those were the very things that led me to CARE, where we worked in 80-some countries around the world with some of the poorest communities, looking at how do you develop long-term strategies to address these root causes of poverty. So I had kind of gone from individual medicine to looking at population medicine and population health to thinking about what were the underlying causes that led to inequities in health, both in this country and then around the world. And I think for me, again, we think about our lives in stages. What brought me into a lot of what I was doing to the very beginning was the inequities that we have here in this country. Growing up as an African-American woman in the 60s, early 70s, you know, I saw a lot of things that were very troubling and disturbing. And the minister talked about the anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination. I was a young teenager at that time, and I saw the kinds of things that happened to cities and saw the bleak despair that so many communities face. And so, you know, that was where I started. And when I had this opportunity to think about coming to a city like Chicago that has real entrenched challenges, but also one of the most engaged civic communities that I've ever seen in any of the cities I've been in, where I think there's an incredible love of this city, there's an incredible sense of goodwill and wanting to do things. So I thought the combination of this venerable organization, 102 years old, well-trusted, relatively well endowed, with this city that has incredible goodwill and a reach in neighborhoods and experience in neighborhoods where there's been huge disinvestment, that I thought that was a potential for doing some really important things. And I also, having spent so much of my time globally, so much of my career globally, this last few years has also shaken me a lot. What's happening here in our own country? And I think that we're at risk as a nation of losing the role that America has played in the world. And that if we don't get our own house straight, I think we're going to have some real challenges for our place in the world and the important place that America plays for the rest of the world. So I think by getting our own house in order, we're not only doing it for ourselves, but I think we're doing it for the world. And I think the moral authority that America has always had has to be rebuilt. And some of that is around how do we address some of these seemingly intractable inequities that exist here and in other places around the country.
You mentioned the challenges.
Long answer to you.
No, that's okay. We're not on television, so I don't get the rap from my producer in my ear, which is what we usually get. But you mentioned the challenges that our city faces in our country. I know you had said when you first came here that you have no concrete plans or a set of plans when it comes to the direction of the trust. You've been here for about 6 months now. You've been sort of on a listening tour with the donors and the grantees. What are you hearing about the challenges that we are facing going forward as a city?
Yeah, and let me just say, I did have ideas. But what I didn't want to do, as somebody who was coming into a new city and a new organization, come in with my own agenda. I wanted that to be informed by the people who were closest to the issues, for the people who know this city better, to the incredible staff that I have the honor and pleasure of working with who really know communities. And so I wanted my thinking to be informed, and I thought that it was a good opportunity with a new leader for us as an organization to step back and to really think about where can this organization that, again, has all these incredible assets really make a bigger difference. And I think, like so many organizations that have, you know, we're a community foundation. We exist to serve the Chicago region and to be a good partner. But I think, as in so many organizations, it's easy to become all things to all people. And, you know, I could read a list of the incredible things that this organization has done. And yes, it has done many things. But I think there's an opportunity to actually be more focused about what we do and perhaps have longer, more sustainable impact on a few things and do those well. So, you know, I have been listening and learning. You know, I spent a lot of my first 6 months just talking to lots of people. There are a lot of people in this room who I've had conversations with to get people's perspectives. You know, I'm now doing a lot more of getting out and seeing things on the ground. I want to really see what are people who are living the experiences on a day-to-day basis of grinding poverty, of lack of resources, of inadequate education. What are they saying about it? And what are their concerns? And I think, you know, we come back to one of the forums we have is On the Table, and many of you have probably been involved with On the Table. We'll be doing that in another month. you know, year after year, we get a lot of, we talk broadly to a broad range of communities, and we get a lot of the same answers back. People are concerned about public safety. They're concerned about getting jobs. They're concerned about education. And they're concerned about the racial tension that exists in this city and the extreme segregation. And so, you know, I think there's a whole range of issues that we could focus on. Or we could step back and say, if we want to have an impact on something, what are the integrated set of activities that make a difference to be able to move the needle on something? So for, to be concrete, so for example, you know, it's widely known that if you go 5 miles in any direction from the loop, you can get a 15 to 20 year gap in life expectancy. So if you live in the loop, if, you know, if you live in northern part of the city, your life expectancy is somewhere between 85, 87. But if you go 5 miles away in some of the poor, disinvested communities, your life expectancy is closer to 65, 67. So, you know, in this city, like so many, but particularly the city, zip code is destiny. And if you want to have an impact on the health, that health gap, it's not going to be just because you get people in to see doctors more often. Mm-hmm. It's going to be because you have grocery stores that, that sell a high quality of food. It's going to be that you have access to education, transportation that allows you to get to a job and keep a job. You know, it's, it, it is whether or not your streets are safe to walk down. So, you know, I think any issue that we take means that we'll have to enter it in a variety of different ways. So that, that's kind of what I think we will be looking at. Where are there some things where there's not exactly white space, but where we as the Chicago Community Trust and the assets that we have as a funder, as a convener, as a trusted voice, in the community, where can we put those assets to best use, and how can we do that in a way that really understands how people live their lives, because we don't live our lives in sectors.
And it's interesting, Dr. Gale mentioned, and that was an insightful study about the gap in the life expectancy. If you all are interested, you should look it up. Because oftentimes when we first hear those numbers, we think, well, violent is the reason. And when you look at it, that's not the
that's
only
not
reason.
That's not the only reason.
Yeah.
It's a reason, and we know it's still the leading cause of death for African-American and Latino young men in, you know, in the adolescent and early age group age range, but it's not the reason for the gap, and it's that whole broad range of other things.
I have to ask you about just the core mission of the Chicago Community Trust. Perhaps all of you in this room understand what the trust does, but by and large, a lot of people, you know, when you do news stories about the trust, when I first came back to Chicago, so I grew up, I went from Chinatown to Rogers Park to Morton Grove, went to U of I. When I came back to take this job at Channel 7 15, 16 years ago now, and we and I first did a story about the trust, I had no idea about the reach of the trust. Do you find that still today, that the community still kind of doesn't completely grasp what the trust does?
Yeah, I think it's, it, that's fair. It's part of why I think we want to be more focused so that we're able to tell our story better, not for the sake of telling a story, but because I think it does help to focus your efforts and focus who you partner with and how you operate. But, you know, the trust is different things to different people. For many people, it is where they it, are able to express their philanthropy. You know, we have over 100, over 1,000, about 1,500 donor advised funds where people are able to work with the trust to express their philanthropic desires. We also serve as a grantee, and particularly a grantee for the nonprofit sector. One of the things that we try to do is to build a strong, healthy nonprofit sector, because we know that those, particularly the community-based organizations, are really important resources for communities. They provide services, but they do more than provide services. They are anchor institutions in many ways in those communities. So we are a grantor. We also raise funds. We work with donors. We hope that we're a good source for people who are interested in making a difference here in Chicago. Think of us as the place where they can get good advice about where can their resources best be used. So, you know, as I said, we're also a convener. We also do a lot in the area of civic engagement through things like On the Table and other activities. So we are a lot of things, and I think that's, again, part of the reason why we're so excited about bringing this all together in a way that can be perhaps more focused, and we can tell our story in perhaps an even more coherent way with the ability to talk about our impact very clearly.
And you do have tremendous impact. I was reading, I think, last year alone, the trust granted out funds to, what, 11,000 nonprofits
right.
in the city and the suburbs. I mean, that's a phenomenal number.
It is, and I think it speaks to the fact that those organizations are so important to the civic life of this community.
I got to ask you also, you know, as we go forward and you look at, you have clearly a wonderful working relationship with your existing donors, longtime major donors. As you look forward to that next generation of inspiring them for civic engagement and philanthropy, how do we enter that space and make that work?
Yeah, and it's a great question, because today's or the next generation of philanthropists are not necessarily the same as today's generation. And we do a lot with young professional advisors, for instance, who are working with younger clients. But, you know, one of the best examples is our collaboration with the Cero family. The Cero family, people know Cero Pharmaceutical, John Cero, who started the pharmaceutical company. And that family was, and still is, one of the most important contributors and donors to the trust. And we've now worked with multiple generations of that family. And I think we have the Kinship Foundation that works with the Cero family is represented here by Renee Michael. You know, it's a wonderful collaboration, and it's the way in which I think we want to do more of our philanthropy. This is not here's money. This is what we want to do with it. Let's talk about this together. Let's co-create programs. So we have this wonderful program that we're doing with the Cero family called Food Land Opportunity that really looks at the fact that we have this high demand for agricultural products here, but we're not really utilizing local production. And so it's a way of really looking at there's a demand, and how do we actually look at that supply so that we're making sure that more local and regional production goes to serve the demand of people here in this region. So, you know, I think it's been a wonderful collaboration. And now we're working with the next generation of the Cero family, who are incredibly excited about continuing this legacy that has been so long with the Cero family and the trust. And I could give other examples, but that's perhaps the best one because it's one of the longest collaborations we've had, and it's been fabulous.
You've also had an experience, I know, the last few months to tour some of the nonprofits that you have granted funds out to. Anything that stands out in your mind right now?
Well, because I was just there, the two that stand out in my mind, it's actually from a project called Benefit Chicago, and people may have heard of Benefit Chicago. It's a new way that we're doing work. This is impact investing. So we're actually giving loans, not grants, to organizations who might be a bit higher risk, who might not be able to qualify for traditional capital. And so we're giving loans, $500,000 and above, to businesses that are able to show that they've got a good and strong business plan and also a social mission. So the two that I just went to, and Will Towns here is the executive director of Benefit Chicago, so it's on my mind. We went to one called Sweet Beginnings.
And
wonderful, wonderful organization that is teaching primarily people who have been in the criminal justice system how to grow bees and then to make honey that is sold, a very high grade of raw, unprocessed honey, and then also to use honey in beauty products. So there's body lotions and body scrubs, and you know, and these are now, you can go into Mariano's and Whole Foods and buy these. And to go there and see these, and the program is fabulous because it's part of a broader program, the North Lawndale Employment Network, where they are able to take people who are reentering and give them skills. And there, I think, if I remember the statistics correctly, you know, where recidivism is about 55% in Illinois, they have a less than 4% recidivism rate because of these programs. Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, when you talk to somebody who has the dignity that having a job does for them, and that they can then go to a Mariano's and see their produce on the shelf. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. The other one was Garfield Produce, which also an incredible story of a couple who were very dedicated to doing what they could in the Garfield area, getting jobs, and again, oftentimes people who are hard to employ because of criminal backgrounds. And they decided, they were thinking of a lot of things, but got decided to do urban farming and found an incredible young man who is the manager. And the loan that we were able to give them was used to upgrade their facility because they had a pretty old facility that wasn't production grade level. And they're now going to be producing, I think he told me something like 100 pounds of microgreens a week, which will allow them to now send that. And I think if I remember the numbers right, it was something like on the order of $250,000 of sales in revenue. That's not net, but still, I mean, a really thriving business, urban farming. And they're, again, employing people who would have otherwise been close to unemployable. And so those are the kinds of stories, and to be able to give loans and the rigor with which they have developed their business plans so that you know that this is going to be a sustainable business, it's pretty impressive. And to your point about the next generation philanthropists, you know, part of the reason we're so excited about impact investing is that that's an area that a lot more young people, they're really interested in, first in impact, but they're also interested in not just giving grants and keeping people in this grant cycle, but how do you actually help people build businesses that then lead to a sustainable, a much more sustainable business model where you're not having to constantly write grants. And it adds a different dignity when you're talking about actually creating jobs as well. So it's doesn't get much better than that.
That sweet beginnings. If you guys have not tried that honey, Dr. Gale is right. It is really good. You got to look for it.
The honey is good. The lotion is great. The body scrub.
Check it out.
Anybody need presents for their wives or their husbands or whoever, you know? Anyway, it's great.
You're right. The dignity part, you can't be. We've done stories on Sweet Beginnings, and when you see it in their faces, that their products and what they have worked so hard for, something that they never thought could be possible, you know, maybe a few months earlier, now they're doing it. That brings us sort of to On the Table. That is something I hope all of you participate in, but when we first heard about it, what a phenomenal concept. Just tell us a little bit more about that. You're about to launch into it again. How has those conversations, do you think, changed the trust and what the trust, you know, is going to do?
Yeah, so I'm going to participate in my first On the Table this year. This is the fifth year, and I'm really, really looking forward to it because, you know, what I hear from people is that having this day that is dedicated to having essentially tough conversations allows people to have conversations that they might not have had otherwise. And it gives communities that had not necessarily interacted with each other the opportunity to interact and open up subjects that are difficult. And out of it, you know, this year we really want to put a big focus on action and doing and taking action. You know, it's been great to have the conversations, and I think in any time social change, you got to start with people talking openly and honestly about issues. But there's a point at which talk doesn't necessarily keep you moving towards action. So this, you know, we're going to put a big focus this year on doing, trying to support people in their efforts to actually come out with tangible, concrete actions and, you know, hopefully be able to come out of that with a set of some maybe really creative, innovative ways in which people can practice social change in their communities.
I got to ask you something. We mentioned in the introduction that Dr. Gale was named by Forbes magazine as one of the 100 most powerful women. But I hope all of you also know that in the Trust's 102-year history, she now is the first woman to lead the Trust. Sure, everybody wants to know. I know I want to know. Did that factor at all into your decision to come here to take this job? What did you think when you knew that you were going to be the first woman to lead this position?
Well, more than that, I'm the first woman to lead in 102 years. And when I divided up 7 by 102 and knew what age I was, I'm like, oh, I hope they don't expect me for 25 years. but no, you know, I've been the first. I look forward to the day when being a woman or being African American is not that unusual, that it is not a first. That said, I take it very seriously. I think that, you know, I am a product of who I am and how the world has interacted with me. And I think that, you know, it is important that I bring my whole self to the job. Part of that is being a woman. I think it's also important that for young women and little girls that they can look up and see somebody that looks like them and that that gives them more hope and courage and sense of what the possible is. So, you know, I think it's important, and I don't treat it lightly.
Well, we are glad you are here. But before we wrap up here, we do have a beautiful video that we want to share with everybody about On the Table that we talked about. So take a look at this video. We'll come back with some questions.
Ideas can come from anywhere. Next to salads, on the other side of coffee cups, in restaurants, kitchens, dining rooms, and boardrooms. It doesn't matter where the idea comes from or who it comes from. What matters is what are you gonna do with it? On the Table. Be a host or a guest. Then move ideas from tables to community. Take action. Change something. Meet, share, do. Put your good ideas into action.
And that truly is what it's all about, putting it all into action and encouraging that next generation to get involved. Well, hello there.
Hi, Judy. Dr. Gale, wasn't this terrific? Let's give him a big round of applause. So we have time for some questions. So if anybody has any questions, or members of our staff will come by. I see someone holding up a blue card over there. Just bring them up here. We'll try to answer as many of these questions as possible. With regard to Open Tables, we've been part of that, the City Club, for several years. We've had the breakfast, and we've had this room filled with people who are creative and energetic and hopefully have produced some action results, as you indicated. And we'll be having another round of Open Table later this spring.
On the Table, on the Table.
On the Table, sorry.
Open Table, that's when you have to
make the reservation.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, this is from one of our sponsors of today's luncheon, Jackie Davidoff. Anger can be an important driver of action. What are you most angry about in Chicago, and how and where does the Trust's mission compel action?
Well, I hope our mission, which is to broadly speaking make the Chicago region vibrant, productive, and prosperous, you know, I hope that overall that spurs us to action. But I guess when I think about what I'm the most angry about, you know, I spent Saturday doing a tour of the South Side, and earlier in the week I was on the West Side, and earlier in the week before that in Little Village. And I live downtown. I'm two blocks from my office, keeping it real simple. And, you know, I'm in this incredible, beautiful city with gleaming buildings. And what I'm incredibly angry about is that when I go to some of these neighborhoods that still, after 50 years, still look like bombed out communities where there's been a total lack of disinvestment and a total lack of compassion for many of the citizens who live in those parts of town. I just think that that kind of gross neglect, lack of development, lack of investment is just unacceptable. And so it's hard for me to realize, and again, I think back, you know, it's 50 years since the Kerner Report was first put out, and there was a report from the, I think, one of the remaining commissioners from that report, Fred Harris, who wrote a book basically saying, you know, nothing has changed in that 50 years since the Kerner Report, which said we're moving to two societies, one white, one black, separate but unequal. And, you know, to look up 50 years and see that that's still the case. Now we, I guess, in Chicago would say there's a tale of three cities if you think of the Latino population. But it's just unexcusable. And so, you know, I think I don't want to, well, I probably won't wake up 50 years from now, but, you know, I don't want the legacy to be that 50 years from now we're saying the same thing in this city, in Chicago, or any other place in the country.
Thank you. By the way, the book that Dr. Gale just mentioned by former U.S. Senator Fred Harris, Native American senator from Oklahoma, I'm about halfway through it. It's really a very interesting read. It's something you might want to consider picking up.
Yeah, Healing the Divide, I think it's called.
Okay. This question is from Susan Malik McKenna. Susan, where are you? City Club member, right? Former commissioner in the city of Chicago. She believes in human potential and assets. The question is, what do you see as our civic community's responsibility in supporting healthy, successful reinsertion of our incarcerated populations?
Yeah, and I'm sure there are many, many people here who know a lot more about the criminal justice system here and what are some of the best policy remedies. You know, I think first and foremost, it's always, you know, I think it starts with caring. Second, it starts with knowing, you know, being aware of what can be done, and then doing. And so I think it's clearly a huge issue, and one where you know, there's lots of clear sense of what some of the policies could be that make a difference. But you know, just as I was talking about the health disparity and the kinds of ways in which you have to think about integrated programs, I don't think there's any one answer or magic bullet. And I think that's probably the thing that I think we get wrong the most, is that if it's a criminal justice issue, we think let's only talk to the people in criminal justice and that's where we're going to find the answers. I think it's when we start having more of this crosstalk between people who bring different pieces of the solution to the table, and when we start bringing different sectors, because I do believe that we've oftentimes let the private sector off the hook too much. I think there's so much that the private industry, businesses are starting to do and can do more. And so I think, you know, we always think social sector issues should only be solved by the nonprofit sector. Well, I think that's putting an undue burden on one sector to solve all the problems. So I think we need government, we need the not-for-profit sector, we need business, and we need everybody working together in a way that brings what they have to the table. And so, you know, it's not as specific about criminal justice, but I do think it's that how do we get people who bring different pieces of the puzzle together to come up with the really comprehensive solutions.
Thank you. This question is from Pastor Martin. Dr. Gale, how do you see the very diverse religious communities assisting your vision for the trust?
Yeah, good question. I think that faith communities have such an important role to play because so much of this is also how do you change community norms and how do you change people's ways of thinking about what's right, what's wrong, what's acceptable, what values? Because, you know, at the core of this, this is really about values and how do we value each other? How do we value our communities? And, you know, faith communities are the ones who are so much a part of helping to shape our norms and our cultural values. So I would love to think about ways in which we can have perhaps even more engaged relationships with our diverse faith communities. And I think, the diversity of the faith communities here that I think have so much to offer as well.
Thank you. This question is from Calvin Holmes with the Chicago Community Loan Fund. Calvin, where are you? Way in the back, okay. I see you're not a member. You become a member. I promise to move you up. I'm a Chicago Bears season ticket holder. It took me 51 years to get from the south end zone to the 40-yard line. So Rome wasn't built in a day, Calvin. Give us a chance. The question is, your point about America needing to reestablish its moral authority in order to lead the world in reducing social inequities is well taken. Can U.S. civil society rebuild our standing in the world without consistent leadership from the White House?
Oh.
This is the City Club. We allow sandbagging.
You know, why I was so excited about coming and working at the local level in a community, in a city, is that I think that a lot of innovation is going to come from our cities. And I do think that, you know, this is a time where we've got a lot of noise going on at the national level, but I think that's not an excuse for not being able to, where we are, start thinking about what are the kernels of social change that can actually make a difference, but that can ripple, can be a ripple effect for the whole nation. So I think, you know, in times where there's perhaps not the kind of leadership that we might want at the national level, I think that's the time when we take the leadership here and really come up with real, tangible, creative solutions.
Thank you. I have two last questions, Dr. Gale. This is from Lance Russell, who's with the Chicago Technical or Technological Academy. Where are you, Mr. Russell? Okay. Foundations have directed most of their educational support towards quote-unquote scalable programs that push into schools. Do you think the trust can do more to directly sponsor schools, such as sponsor a school approach?
You know, it's an approach some have taken. I'm not sure that, you know, whether we'll go to a sponsor a school approach. You know, there's lots of ways of trying to create change. One is that you double down and be very intensive and, you know, in a few areas. Others are you take a broader approach to scaling things that you know work. You know, again, we're in kind of a discovery phase where we're going to step back and think about, given who we are, what's the best way to do it. But, I think there are some of these things where there is no wrong way. It's just what's the way that makes the biggest sense for your particular organization.
Okay. And our final question, and then we'll get to our drawing and a few last remarks. This is from Ellie Foreman with Mesereau Financial. Ellie, where are you? Right down there. Great. Thank you. This is not to get political. Everything's political, okay? What's your personal pet project? If you could write a philanthropic check to one nonprofit or to benefit one issue, what would it be and why? Everybody's going, me.
I know, right? Yeah, you know, I don't know that I have a pet project. You know, I'm still kind of scoping out the landscape. You know, I will say, as I mentioned before, I really do think some of these innovative approaches, particularly things that are building businesses like the ones I mentioned, where we're actually investing capital, helping people start businesses, have a lot of you know, resonance, because when I was at CARE, we did a lot of work with social enterprises and saw that, you know, you can take things that used to be grant funded that had a short life and would never be able to have the kind of long-term impact that's necessary. If you can transfer those into actually being businesses, you know, they're more sustainable. You're bringing in capital that then allows you to continue to improve, to enhance your business and grow your business. So I think that approach generally is a really good one. You know, I also loved, and I'm seeing my colleague Tony Irvin there, and Gary Slutkin was here earlier. You know, I think some of the work in around violence that takes a different approach, the healing healing hurt people, which is a trauma-informed approach that really looks at, you know, young people coming into trauma centers and then really thinking about a much more holistic way of looking not just at their physical, but also their emotional, their psychological. You know, these are young people who have gone through tremendous stress and PTSD, and are we paying attention to the whole person in a way, or the cure violence approach that really looks at public health, a public health approach to violence, and takes it, you know, looks at some of the very things that myself and Gary used to do when we were in HIV, where you look at the high-risk populations, take an epidemiologic approach, look at what the cultural norms are, look at who's at highest risk, and really put your concentrate your efforts there. So I think, you know, for me, it's not a particular project. It's how are we thinking about approaches that are innovative, that are much more integrated, and that are not designed just to put on Band-Aids, but are really thinking about how do you create and sustain change over a long time? Because, you know, the reason why a lot of these things haven't changed is because they are long-term problems, but we're trying to address them with short-term interventions. So I think we've got to have our interventions be commensurate with the problems. So, you know, those are the kinds of things, and there's no one pet project or one check that I'll write. Since that's the last question, let me just close by saying, first of all, Chicago has been the most welcoming city I have ever come to. And I just want to thank so many of you who are here in the audience and others who I've met who have extended such an incredibly warm welcome to me and to my husband, who's returning after having not lived here in 40 years. By the way, if anybody needs a gently used pediatrician, he's still trying to settle into work here. So, I also, you know, just want as the head of an organization, you oftentimes get an incredible amount of congratulations for work that you know is built on the backs of so many people. I saw earlier one of my predecessors, Don Stewart, who was too. He and his wife Isabel, who have been friends, we were both in Atlanta over different times. My incredible staff. I walked into a office where people didn't know who the new leader was going to be. They have welcomed me so graciously. It's an incredible staff. It's probably the most diverse an inclusive staff that I've ever worked with, so it is a real privilege for me to work with those staff. And then finally, my executive committee or our board, who had enough faith in me to bring me on and have been incredibly supportive all along this last 6 months journey. So, you know, thank you, Chicago.
Welcome. So someone just gave me one last question. It's about your husband. Does he accept Medicare?
He's on it.
Okay.